This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you by Heather M., Kim Reed, Jessica L., Kate C., Special Bryn Mawr Correspondent Erica, Turner A., Michael H., Kitty C., Bliss P., Carolyn W., SD, and Rosemary. Thanks so much, you lot. You can join the ranks of Blotter Tipsters at patreon.com/blotterpresents.
Did Paramount's fixers burn evidence at the crime scene? What was the deal with Taylor's pornographic photo stash? Was the deceased director really carrying on simultaneous affairs with 28-year-old Mabel Normand, 19-year-old Mary Miles Minter, and Mary Miles Minter's mother? And did any of this have anything substantive to do with how and why he was murdered? Join us, won't you?
We sure will. As Karina Longworth's You Must Remember This fact checks Hollywood Babylon, we gut check what makes her secret and or forgotten histories of 20th century Tinseltown so compelling. And later, Tyler Mahan Coe reminds us that all that glitters is not gold, but his country music crime podcast might be, as we discuss cocaine and rhinestones. Join me and Kevin Smokler, won't you, for The Blotter Presents, episode 62. Welcome back to our regular format. This is The Blotter Presents, where crime is bad, but a lot of the stories about it are pretty good. I'm your host, Sarah T. Bunting, and I am thrilled to be joined once again by my great good friend and the author of Brat Pack America, A Love Letter to 80s Teen Movies, Kevin Smokler. Howdy, Kevin.
Hey, Sarah T. Bunting. Good to hear from you again, and thanks for having me back.
Oh, thank you. I know that you and I were corresponding on Twitter about the upcoming season of You Must Remember This would be hitting our ear holes, and it returned a few weeks ago.
Yeah. Pant.
I know. I know how long it must take her to do these, and the wait is always well worth it, but man, like, between seasons, I'm like re-listening to old stuff. Anyway, that is our Most Wanted section today. We are looking at the fake news season of You Must Remember This. The episode that we're focusing on in terms of clips is, as you're listening to this, not the most recent, but it's episode 124 on William Desmond Taylor. We'll also be talking a little bit, I think, about the Fatty Arbuckle episode and about Charles Manson's Hollywood season of the podcast.
Indeed.
But first, here's the case file. Silent film director William Desmond Taylor, who may or may not have been at the point of a mother-daughter love triangle, may or may not have been in the closet, and definitely was born with a different name and guilty of abandoning a wife and child in New York under said name to make his way in L.A., was shot to death on the 1st of February, 1922. His murder remains unsolved, but Kenneth Anger felt like he knew the real story as he told it in Hollywood Babylon. And Karina Longworth feels like Anger is probably full of shit. Longworth's indispensable You Must Remember This, which hooked me in with the Charles Manson's Hollywood season a few years ago and has never let go, is back this summer with Fake News, Fact-Checking Hollywood Babylon. Kevin, we talked a little bit off mic the other day about what makes Longworth's work so effective, and I would like to begin with a clip that sets the scene of this episode, refers to another notorious incident discussed in the book, my notes said, but I don't think I know what I'm talking about. It is discussed in another episode of You Must Remember This, and I think I was talking about Bill James's Popular Crime, but we'll get back to that. This clip also showcases Longworth's distinctive diction and tone. Here's clip two.
In 1917, while celebrating their signing of Fatty Arbuckle to a long-term contract, the two men and other executives at their studio and their sister studio, Paramount, had run up a bill of over $1,000 at a Boston brothel. 2 months later, the husband of one of these sexual service providers working that night, and the father of another, who said his daughter was just 17, extorted Zucker and the other execs with the help of the Boston district attorney.
This is absolutely quintessential Longworth.
Boy, there's a lot there.
Yes, there really is. I mean, there's a lot there in content, but I think that her delivery is unique and wonderful, but it does take a little getting used to. Do you find that her very conscientious pronunciation adds or subtracts from your experience of the podcast?
Long pause, fade to black and white. Well, we're already in black and white, aren't we?
Like that's yes, that's we absolutely are. Yeah. Faint Joplin-esque tootling on the in the background as
yeah,
well
on an out of tune harpsichord of some kind. Yeah, her voice does take getting used to, and it is artificial on purpose. I've never met Carina Longworth. I've heard her interviewed a couple of times. It's not 70 decibels different than her normal speaking voice, but the long pauses between syllables, the almost erratic enunciation on certain syllables. There's something deliberately performative and arch about it. I think when we were talking the other day, I said it feels to me like 10% Alfred Hitchcock Presents and like 90% a dispatch from, you know, Carina Longworth's grandmother's drawing room circa 1922 or something like that.
Oh, absolutely. Like, I think that you definitely, particularly when she's talking about stories earlier in the century, that very distinct and distinctive elocution mirrors the often stagey, theatrical acting and plummy Hepburnian accents of the first half of the 20th century on film at times.
Yeah, there's, I mean, one could argue almost simply and reductively that Carina Longworth adopts the manner of speaking of, you know, classical Hollywood, which came from an era when most actors were stage trained, and you know, American style method acting hadn't come into being yet. That came historically significantly after the fall of classical Hollywood. So most people were trained in a British Shakespearean school of acting, which emphasized perfect diction and long vowels and consonants and sort of taking your time and luxuriating over the beauty of the language, or just luxuriating even if the language was pedestrian and dull. So one could simply argue that's what she's doing. I think it's more interesting than that, because her podcast is deliberately a re-reporting and an interrogation of Hollywood myth. And so the idea of speaking in the dialect of Hollywood while at the same time sort of using rigorous deductive logic to take apart the myth a thread at a time, I think is an interesting. There's something almost Jane Austen Riley satirical about it, which I appreciate, where the tone of voice is being used against the thing where the tone of voice comes from and represents.
I think that's part of. I think that she also has a way. And I'm sure that this is in part intentional, but it's becoming much more noticeable in recent weeks and months with everything that's been in the news, hashtag Me Too, et cetera, that the more things change, the more they stay the same in Hollywood. Certainly in the Fatty Arbuckle episode, it does seem like, according to how the crime was charged, there wasn't necessarily a crime, and yet there probably was. Yeah. And the fact that everyone around Arbuckle is sort of trying to make Virginia Rappe seem like a slut who deserved what happened to her, and that she had all these bladder problems because of VD or, you know, whatever they were putting out there.
Yeah.
That this is not, we have not exactly made enlightened leaps and bounds from that. And so I think that vintage diction points up in some ways the the feminist struggle, at least, you know, it depends on which stories she's telling. But I found this also in the Jean and Jane season.
Yeah. I mean, almost like her voice is kind of the ferryman that takes you back and forth across the river between past and present.
Yeah, yeah. That's good.
But yeah, I think sort of elucidates the fact that you're being told a story of in the present of the past through the lens of the present, like you're saying, which brings to, you know, which unearths, you know, how backwards and effed up many of our values were back then, many of our economic and gender and cultural values, and her voice is the tool by which those, the past and the present, are kind of held uncomfortably under the same microscope, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it totally makes sense, because I was just thinking about this in terms of the clip that we just heard, that she's speaking about a time literally 100 years ago where, like, the Boston district attorney is cheerfully probably related to Honey Fitz in some way.
Yeah, she could have said the Boston mob in the exact same tone of voice, and it would have been the same.
It would have been the same roster of people, yeah. I suspect. Yeah. But that she's talking about this, like, cheerful blackmail scheme that they enter into against, like, basically the dread West Coast Jews, let's face it. But then she uses the term sexual service provider without underlining it verbally at all, which, that's a perfect aligning of the holes in the veil, so that you can see from 2018 back to 1917. Like, she's using modern terminology, but then there's this very proper, like, she never met a glottal stop she couldn't completely ignore. This Jersey girl respects that I'm like, I don't know how I would get through even a sentence of her narration.
I think it's important to bring up, and it may be so obvious that it doesn't bear bringing up, but we have a tendency to confuse one's voice in podcast. We have a tendency to assign it a degree of authenticity it perhaps doesn't deserve. Podcast narration, I mean. And I think that's in part the intimacy of it, that it's right in your ear, and in part because of the opt-in of the medium, meaning you have selected to hear this, so you assume the person speaking to you is not only speaking the truth, but speaking in their authentic voice as well. And I think for the most part that's true, but, you know, anyone who has worked for Ira Glass will tell you that the presentation of Ira Glass you hear in This American Life, of a kind of meek, twee, retiring fellow, is not the experience of working with Ira Glass at all. And frankly, This American Life wouldn't be the success it was if that was who he was as a person. So I think we have to watch ourselves around this new fabulous medium of podcasting, and not confusing the way people are speaking, and not giving it a degree of veracity that in this case it itself isn't even asking for.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone thinks that Karina Longworth is pulling up at, like, the Dunkin' drive-through and being like, "I will require an iced coffee to make it, won't you?" Although I do this, like, I quote her little pronunciations just around the house to the cats.
Oh, I love that.
That it's like, yeah, you know, it's time for a snack. And then one cat is, like, kind of being shy outside the kitchen. It's like, "Lucille, join us, won't you?" And she doesn't get it because she's a cat. Yeah, in terms of this, this particular episode's attention to the crime, of course, I highly recommend this podcast sort of in all its seasonal permutations, but
me too.
This episode is not so interested in trying to figure out who done it. Although there are some interesting facts that I think Kenneth Anger failed to care about or include, that she has found, including clip 3, in which she suggests that there was, you know, more than one motive and more than one person with the same motive to kill William Desmond Taylor.
He was apparently so concerned about Mabel and her struggle to stay sober that Taylor agreed to meet with Tom Green, a U.S. attorney who specialized in narcotics cases in Los Angeles. Taylor told Green everything he knew about the use of drugs in the movie industry, a disclosure that could have inspired quite a few people to want to kill him.
There's also, I didn't remember this case from Bill James's Popular Crime, but I flipped to the index in the paperback edition, which is like, there's some addenda in that edition that aren't in the first run hardcover. Mm. And he does talk about it, and he does note he thinks that it was a professional criminal, because he says that where the bullet hole went into Taylor's jacket indicates that he was standing up with his arms behind his head facing the wall, which would suggest a professional criminal, like a robber, like a, you know, pro burglar. So right. I don't know. That doesn't line up with what we just heard. Bill James doesn't seem to think there's much to the love triangle angle, but you know, if you are listening to, if you've been meaning to listen to You Must Remember This and you're like, ooh, that's crimey, like, she is much more about creating an atmosphere and then leading you into it than she is about crime solving. Like, Charles Manson's Hollywood is some of the best podcasting I've ever heard, and I re-listen to it all the time.
Agreed.
But and I think it does actually do, perhaps in spite of itself, an excellent job of sort of analyzing what created Manson and his crimes, which were carried out by other people, the most famous ones anyway. So I think that she sort of, in providing like a tapestry or a social context or an artistic context for various crimes happening, because you know where you have some narcissistic megalomaniacs? Hollywood. Got a couple. So, but she's definitely not, like, it's not going to be like Real Crime Profile or, I don't know how much Sword and Scale does this. I had to stop listening to it because it was too much for me.
I haven't started for exactly the reason you're identifying.
Which really should tell you something given the volume of this stuff that I consume. I think that is her gift generally. And when it comes to, at least for me, someone who does consume this much true crime, just to have that like well embroidered tapestry of what was happening around these events, she does an excellent job at that. And I will also add that a lot of good writing is about the stuff that you cut. And my girl knows how to get it in at 45 minutes. You don't feel cheated
every time.
It's amazing. She's really good.
The thing I love about what you're saying and what Karina Longworth does, both in this William Desmond Taylor episode and in general, is she has a way. The project she set for herself, not only with this season, but with the entire podcast, is by nature speaking of things that have been looked at exhaustively already. With a couple of exceptions, she has a season on Hollywood in World War II, which is probably less commonly known to the average film buff than say, you know, the Dead Blonde season maybe two seasons ago, where every character, you know, is an actress who was blonde who died prematurely, and of the 12 she features, 11 are household names. the project of You Must Remember This is to relook at things that have been looked at exhaustively already. And when that veers into crime, that I understand that's a kind of crime storytelling that is of interest to a lot of people, the sort of re-evaluating of the evidence. That's not particularly of interest to me. What she does beautifully is she sort of takes the piggy bank and turns it over and shakes loose a dime, or maybe like a buffalo head nickel, you didn't know was in there. And I think that's an amazing feat when the obstacle you've put in front of, that Carina Longworth has put in front of yourself, is you probably think you know this story already. And I think, like, in the case of the William Desmond Taylor case, what she does so fabulously is, instead of spending 43 minutes sort of relaying out the evidence and then in a way, and then maybe guessing or saying, I don't have a guess, which either tract would have been uninteresting to me. She says, well, a lot of people had motive to kill this guy. And that's perhaps more interesting, the fact how dangerously this guy seemed to live without intending to, is perhaps more interesting than who actually did it.
And I think she also very effectively, with the clip we just heard, sort of puts a pin in that, you know, without us realizing that a pin was even out, she sort of puts a pin in speculation about who might have done it. By sort of signaling, like, we're never going to know. We are never going to know. But she does, well, there is another clip. I'll just play clip four, and then we can continue on this track.
The angle which the bullet traveled suggested the person holding the gun had been shorter than Taylor and had been pointing the gun upwards. Taylor had been shot not in the heart, but in his left side, and the bullet had punctured his lung before getting stuck in his neck. He had been sitting at his desk, writing checks for his tax return, and it looked as though he had stood up to meet the killer, who had fired the gun at extremely close range, possibly in the middle of an embrace.
Or, I mean, for it to go from his left side, through his lung and lodge in his neck, like, I'm just trying to imagine what kind of, I mean, first of all, this appears to be a southpaw. This person.
Yes.
I'm just trying to imagine what kind of non-standard clinch.
Yeah.
Like, how do you even do? What were you doing? And then there's the like side story about this servant, I guess, or assistant who had been kiting his checks. may have been his brother and disappeared, literally never to be seen or heard from in the historical record ever again, like the day of the murder.
Yeah. And that's one of like a half a dozen possible people where you could provide a reasonable explanation of wanting to kill William Desmond Taylor.
Exactly.
I mean, the fact that the guy had an entirely other family that he abandoned under another name, that he had a bunch of sketchy people working in his house, the fact that he had, you know, ratted on his colleagues at some point while still enjoying the fruits of their labor. I mean, this guy, you lay out the sort of bad decisions that William Desmond Taylor made, and then he ends up dead in the patio in the courtyard of his apartment building. You sort of say, yeah, I could see that happening.
But it's like, who killed him? Who didn't?
Yeah. it's not a complicated decision, but it is a courageous decision when talking about an unsolved murder to tell the story of that murder and not have the possible solution not be your conclusion. In fact, be not even the most interesting part about your story. That's what I appreciate about Carina Longworth's work in this podcast so much.
Yeah, I think that she embraces the fact that at this distance, and she's not always talking about things that happened over 100 years ago, but mm-hmm. often she is. And sometimes it's 60 years ago, and sometimes it's 40 years ago. And the further we get from the 20th century, the more that this is going to be the case, this like Rashomon of versions of various stories that she, you know, even if she's doing nothing but like literally reporting on it, that she'll never know, because everybody who might have known didn't say anything or died in the 30s or what have you. But I think that she like steers into that skid really effectively.
And she seems, without ever spelling it out, she seems to be getting at this thing that's an inelegant word, but this thing that podcasts about crime in specific industries or the result or specific cultures speak to, which is that an investigation of a Hollywood crime or a music industry crime, or even like, you know, a particular like a socialite crime, is always an investigation, is always an interrogation of self-created myth. The reason we're interested is because of the myth this community has spun about itself and what the crime, how the crime sort of creates friction with that myth.
And also what it will reveal to us mere mortal civilians about whatever secret world, be it Hollywood, socialites, like murder among thieves. Like we want to know, we don't just want to know about the crime that occurred in this world. We want to know about the world.
Yeah. Yeah. And if the world
is maybe more than we want to know about the crime.
Agreed. Yes. And if the world is sort of spun out of fantasy and imagination, so much more.
Yeah. And I would recommend for that, absolutely the Charles Manson season. And I think the third episode in that series, I don't remember the episode number offhand, but it will be in our show notes. It's about the crossing of paths of Manson and his family and Dennis Wilson, and how like Dennis Wilson just like maybe he was going to run off the road personally and emotionally anyway. It seems like he might have, just due to his abusive upbringing and so on. But it's like, it's just really well done. The whole season is great.
I think that's episode three.
We're super fans. Yeah, that sounds right. Before we move on to Cocaine and Rhinestones, I would just like to play one last clip in which Longworth relates the reaction of an aspiring lover of of Taylor's, Mary Miles Minter. I laughed out loud at Longworth's acting here. It's very good and very not contemporaneous. It just brought Bullets Over Broadway to mind for me. see what you guys think. Here's clip five.
From there, an hysterical Mary headed to the mortuary, where she exhibited bizarre behavior, which seems to have been the basis for Anger's inaccurate story about her kissing the corpse at the funeral. Here, Mary reportedly offered to give blood to save Taylor. I can lie down on the table and you can pump the blood out of me into him. When the mortician told her that this was not possible and in fact would be useless, she responded, "You don't understand. This is my mate. I have the right. I claim this man."
Just the little voice crack on man is like 17 pounds of actors, am I right, in a very, very short word. Respect. I also love that she, like, occasionally there'll be a little sort of aural asterisk or eye roll, but not all that often. And under the circumstances, she could really be like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, constantly, which is what I would be doing. And that's why she should be doing her podcast and I should be doing this one. But that was just one of those, like, I claim this man. Like, she really could have made fun of this poor child.
Yeah.
For being like, I want to give blood. And the mortician being like, I mean, maybe you should give that blood to your brain because it seems to have been cut off from any nourishment.
Yeah. She could have overplayed that hand and overplayed that entire hand and the spare deck, like, under the card table.
Absolutely.
And she doesn't. And it works so much better because she doesn't. I just want to throw in here, like, if the reason you listen to the blotter is heavy emphasis on the word crime, to listen to this current season of You Must Remember This about Kenneth Anger, particularly the episode about was it Iris Thomas, the unsolved suicide that was in the first or second episode?
Yes, I think that was the first episode.
I think her name is Iris Thomas. And then the recent William Desmond Taylor episode, to listen to that back to back or maybe interlaced with the Charles Manson episode. Because I think you get a really interesting view of how of the relationship between crime and Hollywood. And in most, I think rightfully, in most investigations of violent crime in old Hollywood, what you end up with was that Los Angeles was essentially a frontier town with too much money back then. And a lot of people, you know, with few senses, there was no built up sense of culture or firm foundation for society. So you essentially have a degree of lawlessness there because of what Los Angeles was at that time. And then pair that with the Charles Manson season, which is Los Angeles in the 1960s, when LA has become a fully fledged modern city, but you have Charles Manson is a direct representation of kind of the lethality of Hollywood myth, of the lengths that people are willing to go to be near it, to associate with it, to use it for their own nefarious purposes. You have the sort of dark, evil younger nephew of classic Hollywood crime and the association of violence in Hollywood.
And it's like the difference between noir and just grime. And
yeah,
she does it without ever putting it quite like that. And also there's the intersection of music, post-Watts riots, Los Angeles, the curdling of the free love movement, et cetera, and so on.
The sort of fake sunshine fantasy of Southern California, of the Beach Boys, that is, you know, that is ripped apart, you know, a limb at a time by the late 60s that Manson represents the most perverse version of.
Yep, absolutely. And we will link those in our show notes. But yes, You Must Remember This. The new season is Fake News, Fact-Checking Hollywood Babylon. And as we are recording this a bit early, by the time you hear this, there will be a new episode. And please come on by the-blotter.com and talk about it in the comments. We will have plenty to say. Speaking of plenty to say, Tyler Mahan Coe has plenty to say about the outlaws of country music in our cold case section. I was actually recommended this podcast via one of my other podcasts, Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs, because the podcaster, Tyler Mahan Coe, in addition to doing Cocaine and Rhinestones, also does, I think it's called Your Favorite Band Sucks, which I'm kind of looking forward to digging into. Today we're going to be talking about...
That's a great name for a podcast.
it really is. They both are. And so today we're going to be talking about... This is not that cold a case. The first season of Cocaine and Rhinestones dropped last fall and wound up in February of this year. Episode one was Ernest Tubb. I'll also be talking a little bit about episode three, The Murder Ballad of Spade Cooley. But mostly about the Ernest Tubb episode, which is what made me want to talk about this podcast with Kevin and with all y'all. So here's the case file. Ernest Tubb, the Texas troubadour, was mostly known to me as the subject of a Junior Brown song, which I just sang a bar of badly, before a Twitter follower tipped me to Coe's Cocaine and Rhinestones. Cocaine and Rhinestones isn't just about crime. I would actually characterize it as a country-western version of You Must Remember This, but there's plenty of bad actors here as well, and learning many of these stories at the foot of his father, David Allen Coe of Penitentiary Blues fame, and yes, Coe the Senior had plenty of experience there.
Oh my God, I did not know that the creator of this podcast was the son of David Allen Coe.
I learned that today in a Rolling Stone article. Thank you, Rolling Stone.
I suppose that should have occurred to me, but
I didn't know
that
either.
Completely missed it.
There's definitely going to be a Saturday night special flavor to a lot of the stories that Coe the Jr. chooses. The very first episode of Cocaine and Rhinestones concerns Ernest Tubb's drunken face-off with Jim Denny, the functional head of the Opry in the middle of the last century. After Denny had started a rival music festival to Tubbs, then dared Tubb to do something about it. Clip one.
Denny was a powerful man in Nashville, and he acted like he knew it. Where Ernest Tubb built a reputation for helping young musicians, Jim Denny had a reputation for acting like a dick.
I was just like on my hashtag old lady walk, and I'd been listening along. This is about 22 minutes into an episode that, with liner notes, is about an hour. I'm in the middle of the Bobby Gentry episode right now. That one's like an hour and 45, and he has a thing at the front that's like, yeah, I talked for so long doing this podcast that I lost my voice. Sorry that I sound like Phoebe Buffay. But he definitely has a way of, like, especially the Bobby Gentry one, he just sort of, like, the first 8 minutes are like a meditation on the nature of fame and the nature of desiring fame, that you're like, do we need this? Where is this going? But he has a way of making it pay off. Like, Jim Denny comes up at the beginning of this episode, has just been reintroduced. So far in the episode, it's been like a fairly straight ahead narration with some music, and then he just drops like acting like a dick, and he sounds like Frank Whaley, which it took me forever to figure out who I thought he sounded like. And once I figured it out, he looks nothing like Frank Whaley, but in my mind I picture Frank Whaley in his, you know, big suit from Swimming with Sharks, like, just, you know, I mean I really like the podcast. Had you heard of this podcast before I made you listen to it for
no water? No, I frankly think he looks like Frank Whaley in the, okay, here, you can call me a dick after I say this, but like, I think he looks like Frank Whaley in the director's cut of JFK, you know, where Frank Whaley plays the, he sounds like Frank Whaley in that movie where Frank Whaley plays the impersonator of Lee Harvey Oswald.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah.
I can see it.
Yeah, not super young career opportunities, Frank Whaley, but but yeah, you're absolutely right. But he looks like Jesse Plemons.
Yes, he does.
So it's, yeah, it is weird. Jesse Plemons' voice coming out of or Frank Whaley's voice coming out of Jesse Plemons' body. No, I had not heard of this podcast. I think it's a brilliant concept. I know I like most snotty Northerners, you know, most recovering snotty Northerners, know little to nothing about country music, something I have been trying to heal and repair in adulthood. Because I think the thing this podcast sort of pries open with an awl is that this is told from the inside. This is someone who is descendant of country music royalty, at least more modern country music royalty, and has been hearing these stories his whole life, as he says openly in the first episode. And yet, I think some of it is for the faithful, but a lot of it is for people like you and me, who maybe not specifically you and me, but who come from the outside of country music and dismiss it by minimizing it. Oh, country music is just about, you know, Rhinestone and your woman cheated on you and your dog is sick.
Yeah.
And what this does is it elevates country music to the same mythic status as rock and roll and Hollywood and hip hop, and the other sort of the other American myths we assign a degree of hipness and cultural cachet to.
I think you're really onto something, because I think there's, and I say this all the time, I was just saying it yesterday to our esteemed colleague Stephanie Green, referring to a family member of mine as a country song.
A
double album of country songs, that there is a way of, I think that's, I don't think that's a bad shorthand. I think it's a shorthand that sort of like hints at, Baroque bourbon scented, melodrama. And I don't think it's necessarily a negative, but I think it is also possible to have that be a little bit glib and jokey, when the fact is that a lot of the stories behind country musicians and their music are dark as hell. And we'll get into that a little bit later. First, I'd like to lighten things up with clip 7.
According to Billy Bird, Ernest Tubb's reaction to the Philip Morris Country Music Show undercutting the Jimmy Rogers Memorial Festival was to get drunk and stay drunk for the better part of a week. They carted him back to Nashville, but he was still drinking, and he was still mad as hell at Jim Denny. Finally, he called Denny at home in the middle of the night to cuss him out. Denny said something like, "Well, if you're so mad about it, then how about you just meet me down at WSM right now, and we'll settle things for good." That sounded like a great plan to Ernest Tubb. He strapped on a gun belt with bullets and a .357 Magnum in the holster and drove downtown in his Cadillac wearing house slippers.
I mean, there's so much that is just straight delightful storytelling in there. Like, I also may have announced to a friend yesterday that my intention was, beginning at 4 o'clock p.m., to get drunk and stay drunk for the better part of a week. Like, there's just something about the delivery. It has those Tennessee pronunciation top notes. I think he does drop a because at one point. But there's also that newscaster cadence. And then occasionally he had a reputation for acting like a dick. And then there's Ernest Tubb. It's like 9 in the damn morning. And he drives down with his Cadillac, which I picture having like longhorns on the front.
And like a lot of silver dollars attached to the...
It's like the, what's nuts from Dukes of Hazzard? Boss Hogg used to drive, right?
Yeah, like silver dollars attached to the handles, the door handles.
Yeah. There you go. And hanging from the rear view, dice made out of bison horns. And then he gets out with his like arsenal wearing, but, and I'm sure they weren't bunny slippers, even if they weren't, it's still funny, but bunny slippers. And then what ended up happening is he took a shot. I mean, he'd been drunk for what, a week and a half by this time. He took a shot at some guy and missed, and it wasn't even Jim Denny.
No, I think Mr. Coe's voice is interesting for this subject. And in fact, at the end of this episode, he kind of apologizes for being a bit of a greenhorn at doing this long form storytelling.
He says in the Rolling Stone article, actually, he's like, "I didn't really want to do a podcast, but I know all these stories and nobody else was doing a podcast and it needed to exist. So here we all are," which I thought was really interesting. Anyway, sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, that's actually my favorite reason that any podcast exists. But I think there's an amateur quality of him sort of announcing every line that they all come out at the sort of relatively the same level of importance that I think overall doesn't work. And I have a feeling probably smooths itself out and develops a little more texture as the season goes on. But I also think is strangely sort of almost paradoxically effective for this particular part of the Ernest Tubbs Jim Denny story, because it marches right past the sort of questions glaringly in view. Like, okay, Ernest Tubbs is drunk. Jim Denny challenges him to what I assume is a fist fight. Like, are we going to show up? Are we going to show up at the offices of a radio station, a place of business where 50 to 100 people work, and have it out with our guns in the hallway or on the street in front? No, it's a fist fight that he challenges him to. But Ernest Tubbs straps up anyway and shows and takes his Cadillac. I'm assuming. I have no explanation for that choice other than Ernest Tubbs only had one form of transportation.
Well, and also that it appears that Jim Denny had absolutely no intention of leaving his home.
No, it was almost a threat to make Ernest Tubbs look stupid. Yeah. It was he was going to say it to Ernest Tubbs. So Ernest Tubbs showed up. I don't think Jim Denny knew about the bunny slippers, but that Ernest Tubbs would show up, you know, early in the morning as people were filing in to work at the radio station, there'd be no Jim Denny in sight. And they'd be like, "Hey, Ernest, what are you doing here?" And he'd be like, I was going to wipe the booth with Jim Denny's ass, but he ain't here. I think that's what Jim Denny wanted to have happen. I can only attribute the fact that Ernest Tubbs felt like he needed to come packing to the fact that he was drunk. But
either that, or this was like standard operating procedure at this radio station / the Opry, that periodically some drunk member of the Opry canon would come staggering in the front door waving a six shooter, and people just like were told when they were hired, like, occasionally you're going to have to dive out of the way.
Yeah, yeah.
He's drunk. So if he's aiming at you, he's not going to hit you, is the good news. Bad news is we pick a lot of bullets out of the ceiling. Sorry. Enjoy your health insurance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure it was asked, and I'm sure he just never went into it, but I would have loved to have read, the long magazine profile of Ernest Tubbs where someone gets an answer to the question. So, Ernest, what kind of fight did you think Jim Denny was challenging you to when he said, show up at WSM this morning, you punk ass?
I mean, I think the upshot of this, too, was that Tubb was arrested and they waited like he, you know, sat and played cards with whoever else was in the drunk tank, and then they let him and his slippers go home. And then I don't think this was ever mentioned by either of them to the other one again. But yeah, that's the funny country song. And then you get into, I haven't listened to the Loretta Lynn and the Pill episode yet. That's episode two.
No, me neither.
And episode three is the murder ballad of Spade Cooley. Oh my God. Okay. So Spade Cooley murdered, he beat Ella Mae Cooley, his wife, to death. But this was not the first time that he had nearly beaten her to death. This was an extremely elaborate killing. It's really brutal to hear, and he and Co makes a point of warning listeners that what they're about to hear is awful, and you kind of, at least for me, that kind of just like bounces off the atmosphere of my brain, that it's just like a meteor that just sort of burns up, that it's like, yeah, okay, sure, like, you know, graphic descriptions of violence ahead. Before her death, he stops again to make sure that you understand not only that what you're about to hear is horrifying, but why he feels he has to go ahead with it anyway. And this goes back to what I was saying before about his his motivations for doing this podcast at all, but also that this podcast, one of the podcast's gifts is not just to give you an atmosphere around country music at certain times in the past, but also to show you the parallels to the present day, and B, to underpin country music and its stories with a more serious, dark set of facts that you can't just sort of dismiss it as a joke. Anyway, here is clip 8.
Even if you've made it this far, I've got to tell you, this is about to get so much worse. You should skip ahead to the 48 minute and 20 second mark if you don't want to hear the details of Ella May's death. It's not fun to hear, and it's difficult for me to say, but I feel like it's important to know exactly what happened here, because the way this story ends was very nearly a lot more upsetting than it is now.
He's not wrong about any of that. I appreciated the warning, and I also appreciated that he was almost, like, this was his testimony in memory of Ella May and everything that she endured in the last hour of her life. And once she was functionally dead, the abuse was neatly shifted to their teenage daughter, Melody. This is our last clip.
Spade informed his 14-year-old daughter that she had 3 minutes to get her mother off the floor, or she would have to watch him kill her. Then he went into the living room to yell out a countdown. 1 minute left. Half a minute left, Melody. Time's up, Melody.
There is a little crack in his voice there that basically gets it done. This was like the least horrifying part of that section. Spade Cooley did go to jail for this, which you really kind of, based on the lead up, don't think is going to happen. And then he's paroled, and then on the eve of getting a pardon from Governor Ronald Reagan, gross Governor Ronald Reagan, he's like, you know, I feel like I'm starting a new chapter of my life. Had a heart attack and died. Good. Fuck off.
Yeah, exactly. The universe reached down and squeezed an aorta, and that and then dusted its hands of Spade Cooley.
Thank you, universe. That was overdue. This really is a brutal depiction of her death and of how he kind of leveraged it. I mean, if you choose to listen to this episode, you will have many opportunities to bail out. And as you heard, Co tells you exactly when it's going to happen and when you can tag back into the story. I gutted it out. I'm not sorry I did. But I respected that, given that I think this podcast is about telling these stories with not self-seriousness, but not letting country music and these sort of, you know, pearl snap tales, as you might say, become like a joke, or especially for, like you were saying before, Yankees like us, like I think we can be pretty reductive about it if we don't know the stories or weren't raised around these stories. So I think that he does a great job of that. But episode 3 in particular, I really respected that he like walked through the fire of this horrible story. Because I think it's important to know that this guy who was like the king of Western swing was a fucking monster and a murderer and an abuser and probably was touching his children inappropriately. And it's like, gee, here we all still are, like we were saying before, like that he does line up the veil the same way that Karina Longworth does. And I take your point that his delivery is rather pronouncy and declamatory, but I was relieved to have that like almost opacity in with this particular subject matter.
Oh yeah. I think there's a great like to sort of line up on the table this episode of Cocaine and Rhinestones, the episode of You Must Remember This, that in the Manson season, that is actually about the murders, which begins with Karina Longworth saying, I've avoided writing and recording this episode. I did everything else for this season before this one. And then I also think of the very end of the epic and epically brilliant documentary O.J. Simpson Made in America.
Ah, yes.
which ends with sort of standard photos of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman and the dates of their birth and death. And what you take away from that, and I think what you take away from all from the this portion of Cocaine and Rhinestones and that Manson episode of You Must Remember This, is that if you fully accept all of the myth and retelling and interpretation and historicizing of this particular incident, in the end, an innocent person died a horrible death.
Yeah. And episode 4 of OJ Made in America is the one that everyone is bracing for with the very graphic, unretouched, straight-on photo, crime scene photos of Nicole Simpson and Ronald Goldman. And I was not looking forward to it, and I don't think anyone was looking forward to including it. But it was, again, this testimony, like, this is what these people had to endure in the last moments of their lives, and that is worth having to look at.
Yeah, and I think each of those, and I think in saying this is worth having to look at, we are reminded, and it's a simple reminder, but it's one we need as a culture over and over again, that that our tendency is to fixate on the crime and the person who allegedly perpetrated it.
Oh, sure.
We've spent the better part of 25 years arguing over the guilt or innocence of O.J. Simpson. The innocence of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman is inarguable.
Right.
They were innocent. Ellie Mae Cooley was innocent. Sharon Tate and her friends, Jay Sebring and the other names I'm not remembering, were all innocent. It's very easy to sort of, it's very easy to not even acknowledge that out loud and to immediately shift to what their deaths meant and what it said about the people who perpetrated them and in the world in which they were able to be perpetrated. And I think there's something about the naming of someone and the naming of the way someone died. There's just something very, very fundamentally human about that, which I appreciate.
Yeah, there's a respect there that I think that all of these things that we're talking about, Cocaine and Rhinestones, You Must Remember This, OJ Made in America, these are excellent narratives, like structurally, emotionally, they're extremely effective. They're good stories. But when you are talking about crimes in your storytelling, or as in the case of this here podcast, you're reviewing stories about crime, I feel I often have to remind everyone out loud, like, I'm not reviewing crime. Crime's bad. That's why we don't call it candy.
Yeah.
I'm reviewing the stories about the crime. And the unfortunate fact is that in crime stories, the victim leaves the story and also creates the story. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, God, that's so well put. I've never heard
dying,
it put quite that way.
It's like, here, now the story begins by my story ending, which is a, like, wretched irony for victims and their families. I mean, murder victims. Like, there are obviously other kinds of crime. And you do see in a project like The Keepers that living survivors of this horrible abuse manage to, like, re-enter the story and take it back in this really wonderful way. So there's a lot of different ways to sort of look at that. But, you know, that's something that I think anyone who's talking about crime, no matter what the angle or the context, has to think about. And then there's another layer, which is, if you're too self-righteously congratulatory to your own storytelling about centering the victim, then your story is annoying. And
yeah,
there's a certain podcast I have in mind that, like, they mean well and they're experts, but Rebecca Lavoie, you know who I'm talking about and you agree with me. I'm gonna just leave it there because I enjoy that podcast, but it's like, hashtag her name was X. Like, I mean, that is important. Don't get me wrong. But
yeah.
I think there is a balance. And I think that the projects that we've just been talking about achieve it very well. And LMA, wherever you are, I hope you're good. I hope everything happy is happening for you, because woof.
Yeah. Yeah. I get, you're right. The moralizing around someone's horrible death, like talk about sort of unnecessary self-glorification on the part of the moralizer.
It's just an unfortunate fact that, you know, of course you don't want to forget that people died, and that it's never just one victim who is claimed by a murderer. There's concentric rings of sadness and loss and trauma that attach to that just by the death, never mind the circumstances surrounding it. So, but, you know, then this individual is dead. And then the story that you're reading about in a lot of crime properties is starting, like particularly like 2020 or 48 Hours or the standard like black paperback with the shiny red writing. Like, you're not, this isn't a document about the victim. But I think in the last 10 or 15 years that there's been this, not a movement, but there's just been a shift in how we're thinking about that and how we're presenting that. And I think it's making for better narrative, like higher quality narrative that acknowledges this. It sort of breaks the fourth wall and it's like, well, you know, she is no longer here to tell us how she feels about her death catalyzing this narrative, but here she is anyway. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's very well put. I think you're exactly right.
All right. Well, having disappeared up my own ass there a little bit.
More than happy to go on that trip with you.
any closing comments on cocaine and rhinestones before we move along?
I know he's gearing up for a season two, and I glanced at the Wikipedia page of the podcast before we recorded, and it looks like he's been part of season two. Is he's been given access to the Country Music Hall of Fame archives?
I saw that in this Rolling Stone article has really been a treasure trove for my research.
I'm hoping he digs up some sort of interesting and or forgotten tidbits from country music history. I'm curious as to how Cocaine and Rhinestones is going to sound if it's going down the dark and unforeseen corridors and alleys of country music, or is it going to on purpose stick with sort of the myths and legends that more people know. And I'm worried, is the result going to be different depending on how well people know the story he's telling?
Well, I think that also he seems pretty clear on what he wants this to do and not do. Mm-hmm. So my feeling is if he runs out of material that he's like, well, I said I would do a season four, but I just don't feel like there's anything left, then he'll just stop doing it. So, you know,
I could see that happening.
Yeah, it could. Speaking of things that are happening, Kevin, where else can people find you and your work?
As Sarah said at the top of the hour, I am the author of Brat Pack America, A Love Letter to 80s Teen Movies, a book featuring 55 of your favorite 80s teen movies and all sorts of fun things about them. And I am most typically on Twitter at Weegee, WEEGEE.
Yes, taken from a photographer who I think there's a new book out with some of his crime scene photographs.
Called Flash, which is a great book.
Okay, I'm gonna have to peep that. Until then, got a tip for the Blotter Presents? I can't stop doing it now. Find me on social media, Blotter Presents, on both Facebook and Twitter, or you can email me at bunting@the-blotter.com. You can also comment on the content at the-blotter.com or become an official Blotter tipster at the Blotter's Patreon page. That's patreon.com/blotter. My guest has been Kevin Smokler. He's on Twitter at Ouija. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.